Live from the heartland and the crossroads of America, it's Tony Katz today.
If the president decides that his rival is a corrupt person and he orders the military or orders someone to assassinate him, is that within his official acts that for which he can get immunity?
It would depend on the hypothetical, but we can see that could well be an official act.
He could, and why? Because he's doing it for personal reasons. He's not doing it at, like President Obama is alleged to have done it, to protect the country from a terrorist. He's doing it for personal gain. And isn't that the nature of the allegations here, that he's not doing them, doing these acts in furtherance of an official responsibility? He's doing it for personal gain.
I agree with that characterization of the indictment, and that confirms immunity, because the characterization is that there's a series of official acts that were done for an unlawful purpose.
No, because immunity says even if you did it for personal gain, we won't hold you responsible.
That is Sonia Sotomayor asking questions of Trump's lawyer, John Sauer. I listened to a majority of it, 2 hours of it. It is a fascinating back and forth. Tony Katz today. Good to be with you. Phone number 833-468-8669, 833-GOT-TONY. It really is. I find myself with a thought on how they're going to go, and I'll share that later. And again, I may have to go back over some of this, but this is really a kind of involved concept that can you or can you not bring charges against a former president for things done when they were president. And this whole concept of an official act. William Jacobson is a Cornell law professor and the mind behind legalinsurrection.com. And I spoke to him about it. And I said, just making sure we've got the basic premise, right? The basic understanding of this case, right? Correct?
The question that they took this case on was, and I'm reading it now, is whether and if so, to what extent does a former president enjoy presidential immunity from criminal prosecution for conduct alleged to involve official acts during his tenure in office? This case regards official conduct of the president. The argument's still going on. I don't know if I recall a longer argument where there weren't multiple parts, but it's still going on. But there's been a lot of discussion about private versus public. The issue, the legal issue on which the court took the case, assumes that a president is charged for official acts. And that is the question they are considering.
So it's interesting, the idea of official acts, because in the conversation with Trump's lawyer, one of the things that they asked is, is it an official act if it benefits him? If it benefits not necessarily Trump, but any president, is it always an official act, even if the benefit comes to him directly? And I thought that was an interesting question, because I could not figure out if they're trying to understand the scope of Trump's team, or they're trying to figure out how they would draw the line on what is and isn't. And I couldn't figure out how they were going to draw that line. What did you take from that?
Yeah, I don't think they will draw the line in this opinion. I think they will simply find, in response to their question, that there is presidential immunity for official acts well done in office, and send it back down to the district court to opine on whether the charges in this case involve official acts or not. And I think the more interesting question is, what if it's a combination? And I don't know if they will opine on that or reserve that for another day. And that, I think, is really the dilemma in this case, is that it's a mix of potentially official and potentially private acts that are alleged. And during the questioning, I forget which justice it was, I think it might have been Barrett. Well, what about this allegation? Is that public or private? Or what about that allegation? So I think that's going to be the tougher question. Is what are you going to do where it's a mix of public and private acts? I'm sorry, official and private acts. And that, I don't know if they'll decide that now.
So that was indeed, your memory is solid, talking to William Jacobson, Cornell law professor, the mind behind legalinsurrection.com. That was Trump's lawyer. Sauer is his name, S-A-U-E-R. And he was speaking to Amy Coney Barrett, Justice Barrett. John Sauer is his name. And she asked, so you concede that private acts don't get immunity? To which Sauer responded, we do. And then Barrett went to pages 46 and 47 of the brief that Sauer filed and just started going down the list. And it was a moment of, well, now it really gets tricky. Because we're making the argument that there can be a private act, but who would get to decide the private act? And that's the part where I lost my head. I'm like, how? I have always looked at this case and said, I don't know how the Supreme Court is going to say that someone can't be charged. But I had not considered that there would be a differential to the idea of a private act and a public act. Were you able to determine in listening to the case being argued what they thought was a private act and a public act?
No. I mean, some things, I don't think so. And that's why I don't think the court's going to rule on it. I don't think the court's going to go through the indictment line by line and say this is public and can be charged. I'm not public. I keep saying public. This is official and can be charged, and this is private and can be charged. So I don't think the court's going to do that. I think it's going to announce a rule that the president has immunity for official acts, and then let the lower courts decide and rule based on evidence presented to them what is official and what is not.
So in your view, what does this do to the Jack Smith case specifically on January 6th?
Assuming the ruling is, as I've just articulated, it means it's certainly not going to trial before the election, because that whole process is going to take time. I have no doubt Chutkan will rule on it fairly quickly, but then it goes up on appeal and possibly back to the Supreme Court. And while that's all going on, even if that process were somehow miraculously to be concluded in a month or two, which I think is unlikely, it's still too late to get a trial done before November.
Let me go to the other side of this case. Something that I thought was really interesting was from the Justice Department, the lawyer, the solicitor there, Dreeben. And he was asked by, I think it was Justice Alito, whether or not in the Justice Department's view of this, what if the president makes a mistake? If we take a look at what the Justice Department wants to do in bringing charges, if the president gets bad advice, if the president makes a mistake, if the president sees something one way and it actually turns out to be the other way, well, then he's guilty of a crime, correct? Like you could then go after him, correct? And it seems that the Justice Department was saying, well, look, he has the Attorney General. He has all the counsel that he needs. It's really up to him. They're making the argument that the Trump team is making, I argue, is very difficult. But it seems like the Justice Department was actually trying to say, yeah, it's on the president, and any president can be charged any time for any bad policy or any mistake based on evidence presented that doesn't work out well.
I mean, that's the problem here. Once you loosen the rule about presidential immunity, then there's no end to it. And that's what I think the fear is. I think the question is, how far beyond, or are they even going to discuss at this point, what is an official act? Because the, I forget the term that they use, but the Trump team has a fairly expansive term. It's not just the official act, but it's everything surrounding it. And that would, of course, expand it dramatically. And so they want to say, you know, anything that the president does that is even tangential to an official act, and again, I'm not thinking off the top of my head of the word they use, but anything that's even tangential is covered by immunity. I don't know if the Supreme Court will get into that, you know, how far beyond. I mean, there are things that are clearly an official act of the president, you know, signing a bill, signing an executive order, things like that. But what about things that get into the political sphere that surround what the president does in an official capacity? I don't know if they will get into that or if they will allow the lower courts to sort that out. But that's real, where I think the real nub is. I mean, I don't think even the government here says that Trump could be, you know, indicted for some a presidential proclamation or something like that. Although maybe I'm wrong on that, that, you know, if it was a presidential proclamation to do something illegal, they might say he can be prosecuted. So this is a messy situation. I think we'll get a pronouncement of law and they'll send it back down and say, come back in a year or two.
That's William Jacobson, Cornell Law Professor, LegalInsurrection.com. It was fascinating to listen to, and there were some, there was a real moment where Ketanji Brown Jackson, I thought, was very argumentative with Trump's lawyer John Sauer. And it could be that I'm just taking it wrong because it would, it sounds argumentative to me, but maybe just how SCOTUS acts. And this was one of those exchanges.
Benjamin Franklin said, as we view the prosecution of a chief executive as something that everybody cried out against as unconstitutional. And what George Washington said is, we're worried about factional strife, which will...
No, I'm also, let me put this worry on the table. If the potential for criminal liability is taken off the table, wouldn't there be a significant risk that future presidents would be emboldened to commit crimes with abandon while they're in office? It's right now the fact that we're having this debate because OLC has said that presidents might be prosecuted. Presidents from the beginning of time have understood that that's a possibility. That might be what has kept this office from turning into the kind of crime center that I'm envisioning. But once we say, no criminal liability, Mr. President, you can do whatever you want, I'm worried that we would have a worse problem than the problem of the president feeling constrained to follow the law while he's in office.
I respectfully disagree with that because the regime you've described is the regime we've operated under for 234 years. There has not been an expectation based on 234 years of unbroken political...
All right, let me ask you another question. Let me ask you another question about this.
So it's like a great example of it. She is going through this scenario of her worry, and the point from Trump's attorney is that is how we do it right now. And we only now, 234 years later, have gotten to this conversation. So clearly it's not an issue, and she wants to change the topic. So, you know, was that embarrassing for her, what have you? But there were a lot of those kinds of moments specifically from her. Actually, I thought Sotomayor, while I find myself in a basic state of disagreement with her, I thought that she did ask questions. She actually asked questions of Alito. There was a moment he asked a question. She's like, wait, I don't know why you're saying that. And they had a back and forth. But everybody got involved. There were questions from Clarence Thomas. There were questions from Amy Coney Barrett, Kavanaugh, Gorsuch, everyone. It's an interesting take from William Jacobson that, honestly, they're not going to decide to do anything. They're going to listen to this and be like, meh. We're not sure how you think that you're going to bring the charges, nor are we sure that, you know, you can't bring charges. So we're going to give some kind of level of statement and let the lower courts figure it out. What does my gut tell me? I'll get into that. Keep it here. I'm Tony Katz. We'll be right back. Tupac is suing Drake. That's right. Exactly the story you expected from me. Tony Katz, Tony Katz today. Find everything at TonyKatz.com. The estate of Tupac, although I must say, still alive, he just wants to lead a quiet life now. The estate of Tupac has sent a cease and desist letter to Drake, the rapper, you know, big Toronto Raptors fan, insufferable in that way. So Drake has a song called Tailor Made Freestyle. Full disclosure, I'm not familiar with the song. I didn't get a chance to grab a copy of it there, producer Carl. I don't know if it's safe for radio or what. I don't know the rules there. So there is a track called Tailor Made Freestyle, which is going after Kendrick Lamar. I don't know. Is it a real beef? Is it just made up for the folk? No one knows. But according to the estate of Tupac, the vocals are meant to sound exactly like him. Probably utilized creating AI, created utilizing AI. So the estate of Tupac Shakur is saying that it's a, quote, flagrant violation of Tupac's publicity and the estate's legal right and, quote, a blatant abuse of the legacy of one of the greatest hip-hop artists of all time. We would never give at all, you know, the approval for the use of this, the unauthorized, equally dismaying use of Tupac's voice against Kendrick Lamar, a good friend to the estate who has given nothing but respect to Tupac and his legacy, publicly and privately, compounds the insult. Now, there's a couple things within the story. I think for many, it is... It is lost to the impact of certain people in certain cultures and certain societies. It's been 30 years. It's been 30 years since Tupac Shakur's death. When did he die? What year was this? 1996. 30 years. And he is still impactful. That is fascinating. Like, it still resonates. I'm that is the part of this story that kind of took me. Right? The fact that I never got into Drake, never understood the allure, whatever. I don't have to understand something for something to work. And I can't tell you, I don't know enough about the song to say whether or not he stole lyrics or stole vocals that are meant to resemble or personify or impersonate. And I don't know how that works legally. But the fact that it's getting brought up, the fact that someone will bring it up, that's impact. I wonder how many people 30 years from now are going to try and use lyrics that kind of resemble Taylor Swift. By the way, if I hear or read one more story about Taylor Swift's album and the instant reviews and the issues and the problems and the too many songs, not enough songs. Oh, God. Could we not? This is what I know. Everything, for the most part, sounds like everything else. And she's a billionaire. This is what I know. This is what I know. Right? That's all I know. And I know no other part of this. That all the songs mostly sounding exactly alike and a billionaire. These are the things I know. These are the things I know. I don't know. I never thought about singing in Nashville. Shame on me. If only I had been a singer in Nashville, can you imagine what I'd be hanging out with Selena Gomez today? I'd be an inspiration to teenage girls everywhere. Hold on, this just in. No? Are you sure? Because I'm saying if I just sung it, it doesn't work that way. No. Okay.
All right, well,
I'm glad I do this. It's my milieu, people. Later, I'll sing for you. This is Tony Katz Today.
So you've seen it at Columbia, and you've seen it at NYU, and then you saw it at the University of Texas in Austin, and then Princeton, although it went quickly. Tony Katz Today, good to be with you. An encampment, I guess that's what they're calling it, at Princeton University, because they're going to stand with Hamas. They're doing what they're doing, and they're saying what they're saying. The encampment at Princeton didn't last long, but that's not, I think, the story. The story is, why does this happen in specific places? And is it just specific places? Abigail Anthony joins me right now, Collegiate Network Fellow at National Review, a Princeton graduate, and is currently the Barry Scholar studying linguistics at Oxford University, joins me from the UK right now. This is your alma mater, and they put up these pro-Hamas encampments, and they came down quickly with threats of arrest from the university. And university police. Was Princeton like this when you were there? And if something changed, could you describe that change?
Hi, thanks so much for having me on. So I graduated from Princeton in 2023. And the reality is that Princeton hasn't always been so firm with its progressive protesters. I'll give you one example from when I was an undergrad. So we had a very strict COVID contract that heavily restricted the kinds of social activity that we could engage in. It restricted how many of us could gather in a specific place, things of that nature. So I think it was 2021, I'll have to double check, but hundreds of students were allowed to violate the social contract and gather for an anti-racism protest. But that exact same week, the university didn't let Catholics gather in the Princeton University Chapel for Easter Mass. So we see pretty frequently at Princeton how some of their policies are just simply ignored or not enforced with respect to progressive students.
So I guess the question is, in this case, the university moved quickly. Was that the looking at what's happened to Columbia, looking what happened to Claudine Gay at Harvard, looking what happened to MIT and saying, man, we don't want to be in that company?
Exactly. Yes. And it's worth noting that Princeton, perhaps unlike some of these other schools, Princeton had sort of an advanced notice. So yesterday, National Review published four documents that we obtained from Princeton students showing that they plan to set up an encampment on campus. Even though the students didn't disclose when or where exactly it would occur, it was very clear that there was going to be some sort of encampment at some point at Princeton. The students made it clear that they intended to have at least 20 people in the tents. They said that they have pro bono legal support and trained security. So there was plenty of information that National Review published yesterday morning that allowed the university to prepare. And indeed, we did see the university respond pretty quickly to the article. Within a few hours, the vice president sent an email to all undergraduates warning of consequences for setting up an encampment. Early this morning, the Princeton University president published an op-ed basically stating that the university's free expression policies do not protect things like an encampment, and there are obviously time, place, and manner restrictions. So the university, I think, was able to respond very quickly to the protest that was set up today because it had some sort of advance notice.
Talking to Abigail Anthony of National Review, current Collegiate Network Fellow, Princeton University graduate, where the protests came and went. But you've got another story about how 1,400 academics had signed a letter to boycott Columbia following student arrests. They're not saying the students are wrong. They're saying that Columbia University and Barnard College allowing these students to be arrested is wrong. And now they want to boycott events held at or officially sponsored by Columbia University and Barnard College. This is how you write the story and the statement. And I quote, "We reject as ludicrous the idea that the Columbia administration was forced to call in the NYPD because of the need to, quote, protect students from rhetoric that amounts to harassment and discrimination, unquote." This brings us to what's happening at these, quote unquote, elite schools, Princeton, Columbia, Harvard, NYU. Are the elite schools promoting this, or is this just what happens when you don't actually pay attention to who you're hiring?
I'm not entirely sure that the universities themselves are promoting it. I think they know that these protests give them bad optics. There are certainly professors within the universities who are promoting it. I do think, however, that these universities enable these kinds of protests and effectively protect the students. I'll give you another example. So Harvard College temporarily suspended the Harvard Undergraduate Palestine Solidarity Committee. What this means is that the student group is no longer allowed to operate and organize events. However, I'm not aware of any consequences for the students themselves. So, you know, they can still have some kind of protest, just not under the auspices of that group. And so we see a very clear lack of consequences for individual students. The universities are being very light-handed with any sort of disciplinary measures. Another example is that the Barnard University president said that the college had offered to expunge some of the offenses listed on students' records if it had been the case that those students didn't have prior offenses to the sort of pro-Palestine protests. So we are seeing the universities be incredibly charitable to these students and, you know, do effectively no disciplinary measures. One exception would be Princeton, which has just arrested two students, and I received a statement from the university saying that there would, in fact, be disciplinary consequences following the necessary disciplinary procedures.
Let's go back to you for a moment, a graduate of Princeton in 2023. While I don't know you well, I know your writing, I could make the generalized claim that you're a conservative, but I think it would be certainly more accurate to state that you are clearly not a progressive and not in line with these liberal, assigned to liberal activities that we're seeing in the disruption of campuses and in really this bigotry. How did you survive Princeton? How did you get into Princeton with not being conforming to what we are told is the only acceptable ideology on these types of campuses?
That's a good question. I don't know how I survived Princeton. I ask myself that a lot. When I applied to Princeton, I had no sort of political background. I had been a professional ballerina, and I was training in the ballet studio pretty much 10 to 5 for most of my high school experience. And I did high school online, actually. So I definitely had a very different profile than I do now when I was applying to Princeton. When I was an undergrad, thankfully, I had a lot of support from faculty members like Robert P. George, Keith Whittington, Matt Frank, Bernie Haeckel, some very prominent and vocal supporters of free expression. So I think if I hadn't had them to offer guidance and support, I certainly would have had a much more difficult time as a student.
But you were around these other students. You watched it happen. And that, I think, leads us to the question of how it happens and how it is that
We can agree that the schools clearly hire to an ideology, and they clearly bring students in to an ideology. We have discussed, for example, David Hogg going to Harvard. David Hogg did not earn his way into Harvard via grades. David Hogg from Parkland High School, the shooting that took place, how he was put on television to be an anti-gun zealot by his parents and by adults. He did all of the quote-unquote right things to then be rewarded with an opportunity to go to Harvard. And we certainly see this takes place within administration and with professors. But not every professor sees it the same way, just like you as a student at Princeton doesn't see it the same way. Why is it, in your view, that so few professors and administrators speak out against this behavior? Not necessarily the idea of protest, but these encampments and this clear, unadulterated, violent bigotry.
Sure. So at Princeton specifically, there are many vocal free speech supporters, and some of them have been extremely critical of these sorts of encampment protests. Keith Whittington comes to mind. Robert P. George comes to mind. I can think of plenty conservative alumni who, or maybe I should say not woke alumni, who have been vocal critics. Ilya Shapiro comes to mind. Ed Whalen comes to mind. There are plenty of people who do express their criticism. But I think you and I and all your listeners know that the woke mob on campus, although it might be small, is incredibly vocal, and they will pursue consequences for an individual who upsets them in the slightest, whether it's social or professional or academic. I know that students oftentimes are afraid to speak out because they fear academic consequences. They're afraid to affiliate with anything vaguely conservative leaning because they worry it will affect their employment prospects. And then, of course, there's the social aspect, and you can face ostracization, you can face false accusations, and from the administrative arm of the university, you can face certain types of disciplinary measures. I think it was last year, maybe the year before, my timeline's a bit foggy, but Harvard University, in its mandatory freshman orientation training, I'm sorry, in its mandatory Title IX training, Harvard told students that repeated misgendering could be an offense that would lead to disciplinary consequences. So when you kind of notice the lack of people speaking out about this, these sorts of pro-Gaza, pro-Hamas demonstrations that violate many university policies, the reality is you have to remember that for even the most minor offenses like misgendering, you can face some kind of disciplinary measure or maybe not get tenure. So the reality is that we have plenty of examples of people getting, getting a lot of sort of adverse effects for speaking out, even in the slightest, against woke stances. And so it isn't surprising that we don't see more vocal criticism here.
It's fear. It is fear of losing your job. It's fear of losing a place in society. And then, as we see on these campuses, what physicality could come next? Abigail Anthony of National Review. You can follow her there or on X. Abigail and Words, I believe, is where you follow her. Abigail Anthony, I appreciate you taking the time. More is coming up. I'm Tony Katz.
So in the meantime, I'm at this trial. My constitutional rights have been taken away from me. But every single expert, every legal scholar, every respected scholar has said this is no case. There is no case here. This is just a political witch hunt. Thank you very much.
Witch hunt drink. He said witch hunt. Donald Trump said witch hunt drink. He's not wrong. I'm just saying that there's a lot of mention of witch hunts here. Tony Katz today. I just felt like we could use a drinking game.
I really and truly did. Find everything at TonyKatz.com. He, of course, is talking about the fact that he can't leave the trial in New York. This nonsense brought forward by the district attorney. The judge won't let him leave. Meanwhile, here's the Supreme Court case going on. Fascinating. The argument back and forth. My quick take on it, you know, you heard from William Jacobson, Cornell Law professor, on this. My quick take, as I listened to all of it, was that, I should say as much of it as I could. The argument against Trump's lawyers, which came, you know, it came from everybody, but there was a moment where I thought Ketanji Brown Jackson, Justice Jackson, was interrupting repeatedly, but I could just, you know, not having an expertise, it just could be standard operating procedure within the Supreme Court in and of itself, was to the idea of, is it your argument that the president can commit no crime? Is it your argument that something done for private gain is equivalent to the idea of, well, he's in the job, so therefore it must be for also the public good? It was an interesting argument about where the line is drawn. The conversation happened to Michael Dreeben, who's with the Justice Department, going the other way. Are you saying that the president is not protected by anything? That if the president were to make a mistake, the president is liable? And his answer was, well, he's got the attorney general to ask questions to, so, you know, it was a little shocking. They were both engaged in a bit of, yeah, that's what we're saying. That's what it seemed to me to be the case. The court, I think, is stuck in a really interesting position of, where is the line drawn? And let's say something privately helps you. Could it also not be for the public good? And so what are they going to utilize to come up with that line? My gut take, they're going to say, of course you can charge the president. I mean, I think that's what's going to be. In general, not that specifically Trump did anything wrong regarding January 6th, which I don't think he did. But I might need another day with this to kind of break it down. Find everything at TonyKatz.com. I will catch you all tomorrow, everyone. Take care.